Hi, I'm Harold. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everyone. Thanks for being here. Do I look as small as I feel? Or as naked? Since there aren't any newcomers, I think you all understand the drill. You know, your speaker gets up here and they yak a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'll try and do that for you best as I can. I grew up in Chippewa Falls, a small town north of Madison, about 3.5 hours. I had three older sisters, one younger brother, and two surviving parents. And my childhood, for all practical purposes, was a reasonably happy and well taken care of situation. Boy, I'll tell you, these are hard for me to do, you know. I've done this a few times, and I don't know that they get any easier. I hope for you they get a little better, so I'll just double back. Let's get started. My first experience with alcohol was probably about age 6. I was at a family reunion, a function at my dad's cottage, and one of my cousins, my cousin Bill specifically, handed me a styrofoam cup. There was a keg of beer at the party, and I remember drinking that beer and I think having a good time. And the next thing I knew, I woke up and had this big bump on my head, and I couldn't quite recall what had happened. And so right out of the chute, I drank. I drank to intoxication. I had consequences. I couldn't remember stuff. It was awful. But it was awful fun, too. The next pass was with marijuana. I was walking home from the sixth grade, and my eldest sister's boyfriend and a friend of his picked me up and said, "We'll give you a ride home." And they proceeded to smoke pot out of a pipe. And it was in an old Corvair panel van. And if anybody remembers those, you got the left seat and the right seat, and then right in the middle is your engine. And I was sitting up on the compartment. And I remember taking a couple puffs off that. Now, I don't know if I got high. I certainly wasn't inhaling, but maybe the secondary smoke had some impact on me. I don't remember any particular feeling, but I do remember as soon as we got to our parents' home, I went straight to the outside faucet and I rinsed off my hair and my hands and took a bunch of water. I just didn't want to smell like drugs. So by the time I got to seventh grade and the school system brought in the drug and alcohol awareness speaker, and that person said, you know, essentially drugs and alcohol will kill you, I thought, not true. I've done both and I'm still breathing. So I proceeded to smoke marijuana, probably in junior high, certainly in high school. That was back in the day when the drinking law was 18, and the Sullivans, there was probably 12 of them, good Catholic family. They owned a bar, and you know, we could get in there at 16, and we were drinking often, and certainly to intoxication. So all through high school, I drank, I smoked pot. Somehow graduated. I'll tell you how I graduated. You know, I had a mom that worked inside the school system, and I had a dad that worked for the county. So if I was getting in trouble on the street, I had my enabling system. If I was getting in trouble in school, I had my enabling system. So I never really learned much about responsibility or consequences. Side note, both of my parents were professionals, and they didn't have a lot of time for the five children. And one favorite memory of mine was probably 12 or 13 years old. A guy pulls up in a gray, I think it was Southwest Bell panel van, and he gets out in his green jumpsuit. He says, "Hey kid, I understand we're going to put a second line in your house, another phone." I said, "Yep, it's going upstairs." He says, "You want to watch me?" So for the next probably 90 minutes, that kid was with me in my 12, 13-year-old paradigm. And he taught me that the yellow is the ring and the green is the tip and the black is the ground. And he taught me how to do this. And he just nurtured something in me that needed to be nurtured. And to this day, my vice is all about phones, cellular, VoIP, plain old telephone systems. I love telephones. And there'll be more to that. All in all, I had a pretty good childhood. I really think I did. I was a little different in that when most of the kids were either in the sandbox playing with the Tonka trucks or skipping rope or doing the sorts of things that young people do, I was the guy tinkering with the lawnmower, trying to understand how the battery charger worked. And if my dad did anything, he spent a lot of time with me, or at least allowed me to watch him fix things. And by the time I was probably 10 years old, I can't tell you to this day whether it's a 3/8 box wrench or a 7/16 open end, but by the third time my dad came out from underneath the car and said, "If you get the next right wrench wrong, you're going to get it across the face." So I don't know the size of it, but I can look at that nut and I can tell you which wrench goes to. Just an interesting memory I have. So, as I said, I had the in-school enabling system. I got through high school promptly, went to my first semester of college. It was Christmas break. The academic dismissal letter came. My dad was furious. Absolutely furious. And I had a sister at the time who lived in California, and she said, "You know, what he needs is just a break, maybe go out and get some real life experience." And my dad agreed to it, my mom agreed to it, and so off I went to Los Angeles with my sister, who had been living there for a number of years. And boy, it was the first time I had a real job. You know, I was waiting on tables at the Marriott, paying rent, doing all those kinds of young people real life stuff for the first time. And I don't know if any of you work in the hospitality industry, but that's a different breed, and those people play hard and they party hard. And it wasn't long before I lined up with the folks at the restaurant who went out after work and drank and partied, and one thing led to another, you know. And I started snorting coke, not much, but probably my second year in California, I was introduced to this guy after telling a friend, you know, "I want to buy some coke," and this guy says, "Well, if you buy 3.5 grams as opposed to 1, you can ingest your 1 and then recover what you originally invested," yada, yada, yada. So one thing led to another, and I started dabbling in the drugs and then dealing the drugs to friends, and then pretty soon it escalated to trafficking it, large quantities. And I'd fly all over the country, or somebody would fly for me or with me. And it was absolutely great. I mean, I had a lot of cash. It was fast money, fast girls, fast food, car. You know the whole glamour drama image that you see and hear about in the cocaine world. I was in, and I was in deep. In about my sixth year in California, I had a shoulder injury, and I had to fly back to Wisconsin and get my rotator cuff retied. And I was there for a couple of weeks after the surgery, and I remember I was sitting in the living room, and first my sister walked in. I'm sitting there recovering, you know, and first my sister walks in, then my brother and my dad, then my other sister, and then my other sister and my mom. And I'm thinking, great, we're going to have a little family lunch, you know. So I'm sitting in the recliner, and boy, one by one, you know, they pulled out their pieces of paper and they said this, that, and the other thing about you and your behavior. And I was stunned. You know, I was 26 years old, had this life in California that I thought was the dream. And my sister took the last pass at it, and she turns her list around and she said, we really want you to go to treatment. And I said, I can quit on my own. And she said, that's fine. She said, this is where your Uncle Bill went. This is where your Uncle Bob went. This is where I went. And you need to pick one off the list. Give us 30 days or you're excommunicated from the family. So the next thing I remember, the Trimline telephone's in my hand and she's making me dial. I mean, it just sort of happened. It was very surreal. So I go into the spin dry. About 3 days in, boy, I realize I'm home, you know, but I don't know how to exist on the outside. So at the tail of my treatment time, told the counselor, I'm not going to make it if you send me back to L.A. I don't know how to do this. He says, that's great. Go to this halfway house. Went to the halfway house for 90 days. Completed the program. Now I'm 4 months sober. I get a real job making $6 an hour. I'm driving an Oldsmobile Omega, and it's certainly not what I thought I should be driving, but it was a real car paid for with real money that I earned. And pretty soon the idea of going back to college struck me, and I was probably 2 years sober. And it wasn't just the University of Wisconsin that I got academically dismissed from. I got dismissed from Santa Monica, Dominguez Hills, El Camino, and West Los Angeles. So I had a real piss poor track record. But I thought, typical alcoholic, as they say, I can do that again. And so I did. And, you know, I get through a couple semesters and I'm doing it, and I'm approached by a social worker friend of my mom's, and she says, you know, you're doing pretty good with this AA stuff. We got a couple of delinquents that have AODA issues. Maybe they could come and live with you in foster care. So I took on a couple of kids in foster care. I'm going to school full time. Somebody says, hey, you ought to be a deacon in church. So I start doing that too. Pretty soon I catch a job as an investigator with the district attorney's office. And in my spare time, I'm working at the local drug and alcohol center for revolving door clients, you know. And my last year of college, in the first house I ever bought, $22,000 that I paid for with my hard-earned money, still driving that Oldsmobile Omega, but loving that, loving this house. I'm in my last year of college, and I get this knock on the door. And I answer the door, and I'm like, hello, and it's a couple of guys in suits, and I'm thinking, man, these are, you know, these aren't the Latter-day Saints. You know, these look more like the vacuum cleaner sales guys. And they open up their wallets, and they got these gold shields, and they say, are you Eric so-and-so? And I mean, my heart sunk, you know, that. I said, no. And he said, do you mind if we come in? And I said, sure. They come in. I said, I think I need to call a lawyer. I called a lawyer, and he said, don't say a word. Don't give them anything. So by now I got 4 years, 4.5 years of AA under my belt, so it's all about disclosure and honesty. I remember very specifically hanging that phone up, and Vince Pancoat, the lead investigator with the Bureau, said, "Well, what'd your attorney say?" And he said, "I said he told me not to say a thing." And he said, "Well," I said, "I'm in." You know, and they opened up two briefcases, and they had pictures of Western Union transactions, different copies of what must have been flight itineraries and tickets, and man, I was dead to rights, you know. And at the time, I was looking at a 10-year prison sentence, and boy, I knew it too. And they talked to me for 4 hours, and I was just scared to death. And I kept asking them, am I going? And they said, "We'll let you know in 6 days. So 6 days go by, 6 weeks go by. I'm in the last semester of college, thinking I'm not going to hear from these guys again. And they show up, and they said, "Well, we got some good news and some bad news. The good news is you have been doing all those recovery-related things. You've been pushing your retribution. The bad news is we're still going to convict you, but we're going to do it, or at least charge you on a state level." Well, my dad was the chief judge in Chippewa County, and boy, that was a problem. I mean, on the one hand, my sentence is cut in half from 10 years to 5 years, but on the other, it's like, oh boy, this is going to get out. And sure enough, man, it talked in the paper, judge's son this, judge's son that, and it was all about, you know, it was just a lot of mudslinging, a lot of nasty, you know. And, man, months went on. I graduated from college. I thought, what for, you know, but I finally got my sentencing day, and there were 5 people that spoke for me, naturally the minister, the social worker that had asked me to do the foster care, 2 of my professors, and my AA sponsor. And after 2 hours of testimony, the judge says, "We're going to take a break," and come back 20 minutes later, and he starts going on, and I have the transcript. It's thick. In about 40 minutes, he spent on, "You got no business doing what you were doing. You were wrong. You know, drugs are terrible." At the very last minute, he says, "So you're getting a 5-year sentence." And I'm like, "Oh my God." And he says, "But I'm going to withhold that sentence and put you on 5 years of probation. And if you so much as spit, I'm going to revoke that and you'll go." And man, that was divine intervention, you know. Really grateful that that didn't happen to me. One among us has had to do some time, and I have a special place in my heart for him. I know, but for the grace of God, it could be me again, or you. If that isn't bad enough, I satisfy the terms of probation. I get off early. I thought, can't beat them, I'll join them, you know. So I go to law school. First semester, I'm attending AA meetings. Every university's got them, and they had plenty too. And second semester, first year, not so much. And by the second year, I wasn't going at all. I just sort of drifted away. I was eating, sleeping, breathing, making love to those law books. That's all I did. And so I get into my last year of school again. And I start getting up in the morning. Every morning at 6:15, I get the dry heaves. And I remember I'd probably sit at the kitchen sink. I remember it vividly. I'd do this number for about 5 minutes, and then I'd come back, and there'd be an ache in my neck, and then it would pass. And then I'd go off to school. And finally, it got so bad, my wife said, "You know, maybe you should go see somebody." And I said, "Well, I think I need an eye exam. Really, it's probably focus fatigue, reading all the time. So I go into this eye doctor, the same guy I've been seeing for the last few years, and you know how they have you fill out those forms, you know, are you experiencing this, are you taking that, yada, 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 and I'm like, no, 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 no. And so he sits me down in the chair, and he does this first pass, and then the second one, and then he goes back, and then he goes back again. And he goes, Mr. Stafford, have you been having any symptoms lately? And I'm like, Sean, you haven't called me Mr. Stafford for 5 years, you know. And he said, well, both of your eyes are hemorrhaging. And I said, wow, you know, okay, can we finish the exam? He's like, no, you need to see a neurologist. And I said, you mean like today? And he said, yeah, that'd be a good idea. And he said, how'd you get here? I said, I drove. He said, well, I think you should see a neurologist, and I think you should get that set up right now. And so I start getting out of the chair, and he goes, you need to call your wife. The long and short of that story is he wasn't going to let me drive. He wasn't going to let me leave that facility after disclaiming and acknowledging that, you know, there's something going on in my eyes. So my wife picked me up. I promptly went to this neurologist. He sees the same thing when he looks at my eye, sends me over for an MRI, come back right away, and he puts this MRI up on the reader, and, you know, there's just this egg right there. And he goes, see that? You know, that's a tumor on the fourth ventricle of your brain stem, and that needs to come out right now. And so I saw the neurosurgeon that same day, and it was really interesting because after I talked to the neurosurgeon, you know, I don't know if anybody's seen these guys, but cardiologists, whatever their predilection or specialty is, boy, they are all about telling you the worst possible scenario. And I've always wondered, boy, if somebody told me I got 30 days to live, you know, I got 3-4 credit cards, I'd be gone, you know, France, go someplace I haven't been. And it was interesting because when I left that neurosurgeon's office at 4:30, my first impulse was to go see a lawyer to get my affairs in order. It was weird. In my final days, what I saw is I needed to take care of business. And I always thought that was curious. And I'm not sure why I share it here, but my fantasy was always I'd go skip the light fantastic, and boy, when the rubber hit the road, that wasn't my reaction. And I proceeded to have the first surgery. I had 58 staples up the backside and to the top of my head, and man, in 10 days, I was out of that hospital and back in school, and I was using a walker, and, you know, it looked like one of these turbans on my head, and I couldn't talk. You know, my speech was real messed up, but I was sure as hell going to get back there and finish school, you know, because I had to do that. That was important. And Christmas break comes along, and I go back in for the final post-op, and they meet. I meet with an oncologist, and the neurosurgeon says, you know, good news, bad news. We got the first of that tumor out, but when we're in there, you've got two more over here, nodules, and another nodule over here that needs to come out. And I'm like, all right. He said, so we'll schedule that a month out. So the spring semester, my last year, I was barely out of stitches the first go-around, and I did it in the same place, in the same spot back in my head. Another surgery. Well, this time was different. I really couldn't talk. My right side was real numb, and I couldn't. I was seeing double vision, and it was awful. And they put me in PT or occupational therapy, all those therapies, kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again, you know. And went back to school. They did some more tests, and I had a third surgery. Third one, through the back of my head. And uh, By this time, as you may recall, I went to treatment in 86, and I'd been sober for about 10 years, but not going to AA. And I'm telling you, I woke up from that surgery, and boy, it was like, there's a feeling I can trust. I can remember that. They couldn't shoot that stuff into me fast enough. And I was off to the opiate race. And had radiation, finished school, sat for the bar, had two more surgeries. And then over the next 5 years, four more, you know. So I'm sober for 6 minutes, and then I'm back on the opiate train, and it's back and forth and back and forth. So by 2005, I'd only been able to work for the previous couple of years. I'd been sick the whole time, not just with the addiction, you know, but physically. And I had nothing. All the money that I had earned and all the trust I had earned, I mean, all those bridges were gone. If I wasn't getting the medication from the doctors, I was getting it from clients, I was getting it from friends, I was getting it from wherever I could get it. And I couldn't stop. Finally went, asked my folks for help one more time, went back into Hazleton. I was there for a month, and they couldn't do anything after a month, so they sent me to the long-term facility. And 2 weeks into that, I lose it, and I end up in a psych ward. And I'm there for 30 days, and they can't figure out, you know, what's wrong with me, why everybody else is in treatment, you know, eating and healing and starting to smile again. I just got worse and worse and worse. I think I weighed 132 pounds. And about my third week in the psych ward, the new psychiatrist came in, and he was an ex-addiction specialist for Hazleton. And, you know, he runs me through a couple of tests, and he says, you know, you ever fall down, you ever hit your head, and on and on and on. And finally it comes out, well, you know, I had this brain surgery once. And he's like, okay, so tell me about that. I do. One thing leads to another, and they schedule a neural psych eval, and it comes back, and the doctor sits down with me, and he said, well, let's talk about the results of your tests. You know, clearly and unequivocally, you have traumatic brain injury. My assessment is you also have organic depression. You've certainly got ADD. No wonder you couldn't survive at Hazleton. We're going to send you to this place in way out western Minnesota, you know, where they work on people with traumatic brain injury and dual diagnosis. That's, you know, I'm multi-diagnosed. I go out there. The first 4 weeks are all about chemical dependency, and the next, I think it's 8 weeks, are about vocational training. You know, everyone there had an addiction issue. They were all chemical health patients, as well as people with traumatic brain injuries. And, I mean, ironically, my roommate there was the chief work comp judge for the state of Minnesota. We had a lot of seemingly bright folks that at least used to have a lot of bandwidth there. It was really interesting. And, boy, I'm in the middle of the vocational rehab piece, and one of the clients said, I don't give a shit about what I can't do. I want to know what I can do despite my disability. And I was like, wow, the nickel drops again. And I get out, I go to a halfway house, pick up this job doing lawyer contract work, feeling pretty bad, but you know, that's what I think is the best I can do. Everybody's been telling me, apply for Social Security. You certainly won't. You can't even sling hash at McDonald's because you forget to flip the burgers. And certainly there was plenty of testing to support that. And the one job I did have was work at home. And for whatever reason, maybe it was a geographical escape, but I knew I really needed to just move to Madison. I've always wanted to move to Madison. So I moved to Madison. I start coming to some meetings here. And, you know, you get your eye on somebody that you want to sponsor, and then pretty soon you make that request. And I met with this guy over at the Great Dane, and, you know, and I'm giving him this tale of woe and reciting just what a medical misfit I was. And he listened to me for about 20 minutes. And this guy's an ex-lawyer. He's got a PhD in something else. I mean, he's a really bright guy, very well grounded in his recovery. And I'm giving him my song and dance about just how awful I am. And he says, "You are not that sick." He says, "I'm sure you've got lots of fancy test results that tell you otherwise. But like the guy in treatment said, you know, you're not that sick." And it was the first time, it was like somebody that I really respected. You know, this cat had all the credentials and he was a hardcore AA guy. And man, oh man, it just hit me. And one thing led to another. Kept meeting with them, and pretty soon I advanced, you know, in my career, and now I'm doing it full time. But you know, he doesn't like me giving him a lot of credit for that. But boy, he's the one that I think I certainly owe some gratitude to for turning me around. That's what it was like. That's what happened. And what it's like now. It was probably a year ago I started telling one of my teachers, "I think I want to be done." Pretty soon it's, "I want to kill myself. I want out." So, man, I was really hurting, and it was stress, it was work, it was family, and I called you, Elle, and you came over when I was in the depths of my depression, and man, oh man, we just sat on the floor, and I cried, and I got all that crap out of my system, and then she said, "Now what are we going to do about it?" And I'm grateful for that jump start. This clubhouse has been a real gift to a lot of people. It's certainly been a gift to me. I've met some fantastic people. I believe different people nurture different parts of my personality. If I need quick wit, I call Dave. If I need gentle, I call Jody. If I want to get in touch with my playfulness, I look at Jeannie. You know, Jenny back there, silent water runs deep. And Shelly, you're all about grace, you know. And you know, Connie and Debbie and Amy. Amy's in anger. And look at, she sits right there. She was there on day one. And she was sitting in the same seat that she sits in now. I needed that consistency when I moved here. I needed that kind of reliability. I needed that support. Chuck, man, you're the big little brother I never had. There's Rachel. She's the little sister I never had. You know, I'm grateful to so many people for so many things. And it starts right here. Now we'll get into the prepared or rehearsed part of this. I got 15 minutes left. This is the big book. I've read it cover to cover. several times. I probably haven't read it at home in private for the last 4 years. I'm lazy. I don't do it that way, whatever. So I come to a big book meeting once a week. Same with the 12 by 12. I've read it cover to cover. It's been a long time since I read it at home in private. So I go to a step meeting once a week. Flashcards. This is what I started with. I told all my friends, I'm not worried, I'm too busy, I'm not thinking about this. And the truth of it is, earlier in the week I'm panicking. In the middle of the week I'm really into it. And then by 4 o'clock today it's like, oh my God, what am I going to say? You know, and I've got a dozen texts and emails. And, boy, I hate to pick on you, L. She's like, just think, in 2 hours we'll be at the Great Dane eating. That's my language of love. I'm just thinking about, you know, Scotty gets up here and he does such a nice job on the steps. And, boy, if you didn't get powerless or unmanageable out of what I said, you know, God bless you. Came to believe, what comes to mind is a few years ago I called my niece and she's got Turner syndrome. She's 18 years old, and if you know what Turner syndrome is, it's, she's like a little person, not a midget, not a dwarf, but they don't go beyond prepubescence. And she's like, hey, Uncle. I go, yeah, Catherine, what's up? She said, I met somebody. I said, really? Does your mom know? Nope. Does your dad know? Nope. Why are you telling me? Because I trust you, Uncle. I thought, wow. Why does she trust me? Because I've been coming around here for a while. I've been reading this stuff sometimes. I've been reaching out, you know. She's still dating Max. She still tells me about Max. I think Mom and Dad know now. Step three just came up in a meeting the other day. It was like, I've told the story the first time I water skied, I got up. I was behind a 16-foot fiberglass boat, a 10-horse Johnson, up 100 feet, right? And I thought, I'm 3 steps closer to Jesus, and just as quick I fall. But I don't let go of the rope, and pretty soon I'm swallowing the water. My eyes hurt, and my arms hurt, and I don't know what to do, and I finally let go of the rope. Boom, I come up, the sun's shining, I can breathe again. Because I let go of the rope. And to this day, instinctually, I'm still searching for the hand. But I try and remember to let go. 4, 5, 6, you guys have them. 6, 7, those are my favorites. 11's one of my favorites. Boy, the first couple years for me, 11 was sought through stare and medication. I mean, I was out there. I heard it recently. Somebody read the 5th chapter. Becky, I won't out you on this one, but she said conscious conflict, and I said, well, that's real time for me, you know. A couple of weekends ago, my mother and I, my mom's 85, my mom's a machine. We participated in this Relay for Life, and we've been doing it since 1996, and you know, I don't just love my mom, and I don't just like her. You know, she's been my breath of life. She was the one that believed in me when no one else did. And I hope you folks have that one special person that believes in you. As they say, believes in you long enough for you to believe in yourself. My dad died almost 2 years ago. Boy, that was a new experience. I didn't know what to do, but I showed up. A week ago, Johnny Johnny C. was in here, and he talked about getting the call at the airport and having to drive from Minneapolis to Madison and then go meet with his mom. And it was like, that's exactly how it went for me. I'm in the Baltimore airport. I get to Madison. I got to drive straight up north, and I hold my dad's hand when I die. So I'm at my dad's funeral, and wedding receiving lines are fun. Funeral receiving lines are drag. But pretty long one, and I'll never forget. I don't know this lady. I've never seen her before. I've never seen her since. But definitely elderly, and she comes up, and you know, she grabs my hand. And people have been saying all kinds of kind things for days. And she just looks at me. She looks at me a little longer. And, you know, pretty soon a tear comes rolling down her cheek, and then a couple more. And she gives me a couple squeezes, one more look, and she's gone. And that lady authentically identified with where I was at right in that moment. Real valuable lesson for me on a couple of levels. Most certainly, real rich, intimate communication ain't all about verbal. Nephew called me today. He got another speeding ticket. This time it's going to be 8 points because he was going really fast. I know what they say in Al-Anon and AA, but you can bet I'll do what I can to help Joey, and I don't give a shit. Let somebody else give him the consequences. That's just the way I run. Talked to a lot of people, you know, a lot of people suggested preparing and planning. Elle even offered, you know, to let me do a dry run. It's interesting as we mature in the program, kind of like relying on God, we rely on our sponsors less and less and less. So finally, in the last hour, I call my sponsor this morning, and we exchange sentences, and he's on his own trip, but he said, you know, just honor yourself and honor the people around you. And that was great, man. I'm here to say from the bottom of my heart just how grateful I am to the peers in the meeting tonight, and certainly the folks that can't be with us tonight and from afar. People used to say, AA saved my life, and I'm thinking, what a bunch of fucking drama, you know. Let me tell you something. I am fighting for my life on a ton of levels, and every tool I need, I get right here. I get right here. You people are my teachers. You're my pit crew. You're my peers. Heard enough? I don't know. I think I've learned how to live, and I think I've learned I've learned to live, and learning to live is about learning to live outside yourself.